What's your favorite month of the year from a weather standpoint?
Probably July.
July. Okay. So you like it hot, humid?
Yes.
Okay. That's fair.
I was going back and forth between June, July, and August.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't typically get that answer.
I know.
I used to say September, but I don't know if it's global warming or not, but September can be pretty hot now still too. Right. So now it's like the latter half of September, the first half of October, where it's still, granted, Indiana fluctuates all over, but let's say it's low to mid 70s during the day and then cools mm-hmm. off at night.
I don't like that less cool humidity. Off at night thing.
No?
No, I'm cold. I'm in a 70 today and I'm running around in the jacket. So.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, I much prefer the hot weather.
Well, that's fair. Now, yeah. I would go with that answer more so than a December, January. I agree with you there.
Yes.
I mean, and I don't know, it's starting to make me feel old, but like when I was a kid, cold didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I walk out there in January, go to work, it's like zero, and I'm like, holy smokes.
Yeah. I just want to hibernate from about December through the February.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. We could start being snowbirds,
uh-huh.
and then we'll do a podcast from wherever that okay. place may be, whether it's Florida or wherever. All right, we'll coordinate for that for the next episode.
Okay, here we go.
All right, cool.
All expenses paid, right?
Well, sure, yeah. We know how to fundraise. I mean, I think we could figure that out.
That's funny you say that, though, because I would have never thought that I would be working in a position where a lot of what I do is fundraising.
Yeah.
And I never would have thought that I would be okay with that. But it's a necessity if we're going to do the work that we want to
exactly.
do and that needs to be done. So
right. All right. Well, let's hold that thought. We'll okay. come back to that.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Is this thing on?
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Summits Podcast. Thank you all for joining us from wherever you guys get your podcasts. And if you happen to be joining us from the Heroes Foundation YouTube channel, thank you for tuning in. Also, if you're doing it that way, don't forget, subscribe, like, share, all that good stuff. Comment if you'd like. Only good ones though, of course. Hey, today we've got a special guest, Miss Lisa Hayes. Lisa, welcome to the Summits Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So you have two fancy titles, not just one. So I'm gonna throw these out there. First of all, you are Director of Women's Health Services at the Jenna Surratt Free Clinic, correct?
Correct.
All right. And Executive Director of Pink Forever Ending Disparities. Yes. Before we go into, well, actually, let's start with your personal intro and then we'll go into these organizations.
All right. So born here in Indianapolis, raised in Pike Township.
Okay. Yep.
And attended Pike Township schools and left there. Actually, you know, went to college, followed that by law school.
No.
And after working some years in D.C. and well, I was in New Orleans for law school, but
okay.
came back here to Indianapolis, Midwest,
yeah.
and practiced law here for about 20 years or so.
Okay.
And then not long after that, a few years after that, as I was sort of trying to transition into a different career, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And that changed the trajectory of not only my personal life, but my professional life as well. So,
where did you go to law school in New Orleans?
Yes, Tulane.
Tulane
University, yes.
I was thinking Tulane, but I wasn't sure, so I didn't want to throw it out there.
And there's Loyola Law School is down there as
right.
well.
So, yeah. My older sister went to Tulane for undergrad.
Uh-oh.
So, small world.
Yes.
I went down to visit a few times. It was a good place to visit.
Exactly. It's a nice place to visit. But one of the reasons I came back to Indianapolis was I wasn't convinced that I would want to live there and try to raise a family there and
sure.
do all that there.
Yeah. But good food, good scene,
excellent
a lot
food.
Of history.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And much different from Indianapolis in the Midwest. So that was one of the things that drew me as I was trying to decide where to go to law school. I really did want to try to get a different experience.
Right. That was going to be my next question. Was like, why Tulane versus, you know, IU or anywhere else around here?
Well, two things. One is that desire to get a different experience. And
right.
then follow the scholarship money.
Always good
so,
too.
Yeah. So yep. It was offered there and not here in Indiana, much to the chagrin of my parents who thought I should stay here.
Right.
And I had a really easy out. Well, I'm getting scholarship money there. I'm not getting scholarship money here.
Right. So. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, looking back, I guess two questions. One, did you feel like that was a good decision? And two, now that we're, you know, both older and looking back, as we try to tell our kids or other younger folks, and they don't seem to get it sometimes, we're like, mm-hmm. Look, go do that now, because when you're 30, 40, 50, like, you're going to have too many other things going on and you won't have that opportunity. So, you know, yeah, if you want to go away, get that experience, yeah. Go do it now.
Exactly. And I really do think that it was a good choice to get away from the Midwest just to yeah. experience, you know, another culture. Another climate,
right.
You know, just different people, and to get away from home, essentially, and, right. and learn how to live independently and see things, different perspectives from different people. So that was definitely good. And then also my educational experience there turned out to be significant, but because, yes, I was going to law school, but then during the summers, I was doing internships in different states and, right. again, was exposed to a lot of different things, which helped me to determine what I wanted to do with a law degree.
Sure, yeah. Right. So when you came back to Indy, did you come back to Indy straight after law school?
I did.
Okay, and then where did yes. you practice for about 20 years?
Well, it was, I first started out with what was then called Legal Services Organization. It's now okay. called Indiana Legal Services. And I came back here, actually started out on a fellowship that was awarded where legal fellows were assigned to different legal services offices around the country. Okay. I wanted to come to Indianapolis if I was going to do that. And right. luckily I was assigned here. But we represented low-income people and families in civil matters. And so that's where I started out and remained there for, gosh, now I'm forgetting. I guess it was about 10 years.
Okay.
Doing a variety of things, mostly a lot of family law related cases mm-hmm. and things like divorce and child custody. And
right.
Did some a lot of work with children who had been removed from their parents' home and representing those parents. So that was quite eye-opening. So a lot of that, a lot of cases involving government benefits like Social Security and Medicaid and things like that. So did that, and then from there moved on to work in state government. I was okay. actually joined the Attorney General's office when the first Black female Attorney General of Indiana, Pam Carter, was elected, and she, her staff reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in joining her staff at the Attorney General's office, and I was, and so I moved there, and then ended up staying in state government for another 10 years or so.
Okay. So when you were at the AG's office, what type of things were you doing?
So I went in as the head of the Consumer Protection Division.
Okay.
And so a lot of that work in consumer protection related to what I'd been doing with legal services in terms of making sure that people, particularly people who traditionally were underserved, were accorded their rights as consumers.
Right.
And if they had, you know, complaints involving other companies or also complaints involving health professionals. That okay. was also within our purview.
Sure.
And so I oversaw that division, the Consumer Protection Division.
Right. So watching out for scams and
exactly
numerous other things, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay. So you were there and you'd been there about 10 years or so. So you're 20 years out post law school. And you get some new personal news that you probably certainly weren't anticipating.
Not at all.
So, Lisa, what is your cancer story?
So I, like I said, I had been working, in state government, and at some point I decided that, okay, it's time for another change. And I had gone into, working with some, in private industry, but also was trying somewhat moving away from the, legal profession. I'd done that. I wouldn't say I was burnt out, but certainly was looking for a change.
Sure, yeah.
And I had been doing some work with a company where I was doing quality assurance kind of work with the healthcare industry company. Okay. And then after that, I when I was with them, was laid off. And it was while I was laid off did not have any health insurance.
Right.
That I found a lump, actually a lump under my arm, not in my okay. breast, but found a lump under my arm. And initially I said, wonder what that is, but kind of put it off because I wasn't insured. Yeah. Finances were tight with the family. But then eventually I did go get it checked out and it turned out to be breast cancer. And so it was definitely a surprise. I did not have any family history of breast cancer.
Okay.
I had been in great health pretty much all of my life. Literally had never been hospitalized for anything okay. other than birthing three children.
Right.
Right. And when I was a senior in high school, I had a broken collarbone.
Okay.
Those were my hospital experiences, right. really. And I actually thought, I was in pretty good shape. I wasn't overweight. I thought I ate fairly healthy. Like I said, didn't have any family history. So it was shocking for me to be the one diagnosed with breast cancer.
If you don't mind me asking, and you don't have to share if you don't want to, about how old were you at that time?
I was 49.
49. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're at a point, careers, not sure which direction you're headed. A lot of things going on. What challenges, every person diagnosed with cancer has a variety of challenges, and how they deal with that news is a little bit different. Share, if you would, what was kind of going through your mind at the time? How did you handle that?
Interesting question, because I actually, as I said, I was uninsured at the time. So it was really, my foremost concern was, oh God, how are we going to pay for treatment? Will I even be able to get treatment? And I had gone to the doctor and found out my diagnosis, which was interesting too, because I went through it and I had a mammogram and a biopsy, and I actually had those services performed through a program through the Little Red Door,
okay.
which is a cancer agency here, mm-hmm. here in the city. And so the doctor I had gone to and had the biopsy, their office called me and asked me to come in. And I was pushing. I was like, well, why do I have to come in? Can you just tell me over the phone what's going on? And really what was pressing on my mind was I was in the middle of a conversation with a company that was about to, well, they offered me a job, and we were just talking about the logistics. They were talking about there was an event going on in Chicago the following weekend and whether or not I could come and sort of start orienting at that
sure,
event.
Yeah.
So anyway, went to the doctor. My sister-in-law went with me, and at the request of my husband, mm-hmm. who was working. And so we went, and they gave me my diagnosis, and I said, okay, so can I still go to Chicago this coming up weekend? Because right. I'm starting this new job and I really need to go. And it was a nurse practitioner in the room. And she said, did you hear what I just said? I kind of need you to focus on, let's right. just talk about what happens next and your treatment. And probably now is not the best time to decide whether or not, you okay. want to go to Chicago. So ultimately I was not able to take that job because my treatment was going to involve chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and the job was going to require a lot of travel, and doing chemotherapy just was not going to be advisable to be
right.
Subjected to a lot of different environments, and just the stress of just doing air travel and doing all those things. So ultimately, I was not able to accept the job and went right into treatment.
Okay. How long did treatment last for you?
Totally about 9 months. So okay. I did surgery first, mm-hmm. which is a lot different now in terms of breast cancer treatment, which we may talk about later, but did surgery first and then did chemotherapy. So I was doing chemotherapy every other week.
Okay.
And the first rounds of it was actually being infused with two different types of medicines. And so did that for 4 weeks and then followed that by another 4 weeks that were every other week. So I should say four sessions every other week with one drug. Then I got a little break for about a month and actually started radiation the day before Thanksgiving.
Okay. Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And so I had radiation through the holiday season and finished that up in mid-January.
Okay. Yeah. The biweekly thing sounds familiar. I was biweekly as well, other than there were two different times where my cell count was so low that they decided to postpone another week. But, and I, the more people I've talked to, regardless of what like chemo regimen they were on or cancer type, like that's not uncommon.
Right.
It's quite a bit.
Right. In fact, after my third chemotherapy, I developed what turned out to be an allergic reaction to one of the drugs.
Really? Okay.
That I was given. But it took them a week to figure that out. And it was a week that I ended up spending in the hospital. It was probably the scariest time of my whole treatment. But surprising too, because I'd had this drug given twice. Right. And then after the third administration of it, I all of a sudden started having fevers and different things happening. And then I was supposed to do my next treatment, which was postponed because of the fevers. And it was sort of like cold symptoms. But then because they didn't know what it was, I was in the hospital. And then my lungs started filling up with fluid. And then I'm in isolation. And then they're talking about doing a biopsy of my lungs. And of course, all things were going through my head like, oh gosh, the cancer spread to my lungs and this is just going to be awful. But it turned out to be I was having an allergic reaction. But that reaction, that was just the way that my body responded to it. And so eventually, after a week in that, they figured out what it was and said, okay, no more of that drug for you. But I was only going to get one more administration of it. So they said they thought that was probably enough. It would not impact my long-term survivorship. So then just moved on to the next drug.
Okay. Well, that's good. And glad we can have that conversation now.
Yes, definitely.
So you're done with radiation. How often did you go back for follow-ups at that point?
I initially was every 3 months.
Okay.
And then it stretched out to every 6 months and then every year. But kind of a funny story about that. When I finished radiation, went in to see my oncologist, and she says, oh, everything is good. You can go. And I was like, no, where are my drugs? And I was saying that because I knew of other cancer survivors who were on things like tamoxifen and other anti-hormonal drugs. What I didn't understand at the time was that because I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, which is not hormone driven, but also there had been no therapies, you know, post-treatment therapies that had been developed to help with, you know, fighting off the possibility of a recurrence or just to manage, you know, the after treatment. And she was just like, you're not going to take anything. And I wouldn't say I was devastated, but I had a lot of questions like, well, what are you going to do? Am I just going to wait and see if this is going to come back? And then she starts talking about, well, we're going to, you know, have you come in and do blood work every 3 months and check you. And I said, so what's the blood work going to show? And she said, well, we'll just be looking for changes in your blood work. I said, so will it identify like if cancer is coming back? No, not really that. We're just looking for if there's any change in those things that might be an indication that something's going on. So it wasn't very comforting. I'll say that. It was just sort of like, okay, I'm out here and I'll just wait for the next shoe to drop. So, but it didn't. The shoe didn't drop. And kind of, I guess if there's anything nice to say about triple negative breast cancer, if you make it surviving 3 years, 3 to 4 years, then your chances of not having a recurrence are much higher, which is different than some of the other types of breast cancer where the standard is more like 5 years of survivorship before you can kind of exhale and say, oh, okay, I'm going to survive this.
Then to now, how much has changed with If a female is diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer today, like very similar story to you, like almost identical, but now we're in 2023, what has changed since when you went through it that you've seen?
Several things. One is that when I was diagnosed, pretty much the standard chemotherapy was the standard of care in triple negative breast cancer. Now, you know, through research, which you and I think both have an affinity for, through research, they have there are some testing that can be done on your breast cancer tumor, genomic kind of testing to look at the characteristics of that tumor and to identify, you know, what kinds of treatments might be best based upon your genomic makeup, as well as, you know, like what drugs might work best. And even things as much as, you know, how you might be impacted by side effects from certain drugs.
Right.
So, so now because of that research and through some of the testing, it's also can be identified whether or not chemotherapy is advisable for you, if it would be, you know, helpful for you, or could you forego chemotherapy and perhaps have some other kinds of treatments.
Okay.
So that's available. But then the other thing now is it's much more common to do the chemotherapy first rather than the surgery. I had my surgery first, and a lot of that was because the size of my tumor was very small. It was going to be a fairly easy surgery to remove that.
Okay.
And then, like I said, since chemotherapy was the standard of care for triple negative at that time, I was going to have it anyway. And so, okay, get the cancer out, get the tumor out, and then do the chemotherapy.
Right.
Now, particularly with if you have larger tumors, chemotherapy is done first as a way to not only shrink the tumor, which might lead to an easier type of surgery or breast conserving surgery. But then also it gives your treatment team, and particularly the oncologist, the ability to look and see how the chemotherapy is working, whether or not it's working.
Right.
And so, you know, whether or not it is in fact shrinking the tumor. So that you see that happening more often now than when I was treated, 15 years ago or so.
Right. When we were like 12.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
15 maybe.
I mean, I must have just been out of high school when that happened.
Well, let's talk about you have two different jobs today.
I do.
Let's call it that. Let's start with the Director of Women's Health Services at the Genesaret Free Clinic. What is the clinic? What do you guys do there, and what do you do personally in your role?
Right. So, Genesaret Free Clinic provides free health care for adults who are uninsured or underinsured, or even those who just face some barrier to accessing medical care, sort of in the traditional environment. And so we provide that care for free. We have clinicians on staff, as well as just a great group of volunteers that provide that medical service, as well as the nursing, the pharmacist role, the medical clerk role, that they collectively provide these services. We have a clinic hub that's actually inside of the St. Vincent de Paul Food Pantry, which the largest food pantry, I believe, in Indiana. And so the beauty of that is that some of the very people that may be getting food and other services at the food pantry are also people who need medical care. And so it turns out to be sort of like one-stop shopping. You can go come and get those services, get food and other services at the pantry, and also get medical care there. So I have actually been there since about 2 months after I finished my own breast cancer treatment, which is just really, I think, is almost like it was meant to be.
I was just going to say, like, now that you're looking back, that's been how many years? 15-ish?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I mean, we were both at an age where we can look back on things and say, God, you know, was that fate? Is that just a pure coincidence?
Scott, I'm going to be honest with you. That's the way that I look at it. And I'll tell you why, Vince. Like many, you know, people who are diagnosed with cancer, one of the things that always runs through your head, why me?
Right.
You know? And at some point, even during treatment, I turned that around and say, why not me? I mean, I wasn't any more special than anybody else. Why not me? And then that led to, it's me because God has something for me to do that I could not do if I had not experienced this. Now, I'm not saying God gave me cancer. That's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
But what I am saying is that it opened an opportunity for me to turn my, you know, my career, my life, really, my passion to something else. And so, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I was in between jobs when I was diagnosed. And so for most of my treatment, again, because of just the treatment regimen, I wasn't even trying to work.
Yeah.
But once I got through surgery and chemotherapy and was just starting radiation, I started kind of, you know, thinking, okay, what am I going to do with the rest of my life here? And I really had decided at that point, I didn't want to go back necessarily to practicing law.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wasn't for sure, except for the fact that I knew I wanted to do something that where I was giving back and helping other people, particularly someone who might be in a position like I was, having some kind of whether it be a medical condition or something else that happened, some life happening that they weren't really prepared for, but was able to find resources to help them. And that's exactly what, you know, happened in my situation. So as I started thinking about and trying to, you know, figure out where could I, you know, apply for jobs, I actually went to a networking group that I was, you know, familiar with and just start pulling out some feelers about, you know, what's out there, what, and trying to figure out where I might fit in. And somebody within that group sent me a job notice from Gennesaret. They were looking for someone to serve as their director of women's health. Their women's health then and still now focuses on breast and cervical cancer and both providing screenings and education and prevention services. So, you know, I looked at the job description and saw that, you know, Gennesaret serves many of the same types of people that were in situations similar to that I helped in legal situations with legal services. So I got to think, well, I think I could do this. I certainly have an understanding of cancer now. Right. I know what it feels like to be diagnosed when I had no health insurance and the uncertainties about getting treatment. And so I applied, and I won't go through the long story, but basically it was kind of like the initial reaction was, why would you want to work here? You have a law degree. We can't pay you, like, you know, the kind of salaries that you may have been accustomed to. And why would you want to do this? And it really was. It was about my cancer experience that really changed me and my mindset. So it all worked out. And 2 months after I finished treatment, I was at Gennesaret.
Awesome.
Starting that position is still there.
It's like you had this extra motivation too.
Definitely.
I mean, I get, and I'm sure you get the same question sometimes. And they don't mean offense by it, but I often will get, hey, you've been doing this for 22 or 23 years as like a side hustle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you still do it? Why do you put yourself through the added stress on top of your regular job? And I go, because every time I turn around, there's another cancer story.
Exactly.
Just in the last, call it 5 years, I've lost two close friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, we all have our days where we're like, oh man, this is a lot.
Right.
But then a situation like that happens and, you know, keeping this PC, like this fire inside of me reignites again and gets real. I get really angry.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I'm back in. Let's go.
The need is there. You can't stop. I would feel bad if I stopped at that point. And I often say to people, you know, I would love to be able to work myself out of this job because that means the, you know, all the issues that I'm trying to, you know, do my part to address as it relates to breast cancer would have been solved. So, work me out of this job.
I agree. You mentioned earlier the thought of why me, and then you flip that around and say, why not me? And it's true. It's the situations that I mentioned, like, you know, a friend of mine passed away almost, 2 years ago this month. And for me, the question is like, why him?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I still here?
Yes.
And he's not.
Right.
She's not.
Yeah. Like that. I had a lot of that, Vince, because before I was diagnosed, I had a sister-in-law who was diagnosed. And she actually helped me quite a bit after I was diagnosed with just things like, well, why is my tongue turning black from chemotherapy?
Sure, yeah.
That kind of thing. But then not only did she pass away, my mother-in-law, who was diagnosed after me, also did not survive. Okay. And so, you know, early on in the work that I was doing, it was really about them, you know, but I recall when my, you know, sister-in-law had gotten really sick, you know, the cancer had spread. And one day I said to one of her sisters, why is this happening to her? You know, I'm still living. And I think that is actually called survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember clearly her sister saying to me, because that's not for you. That's what her lot in life is. You have something different that God wants you to do. And that I remember that constantly, because that really is it, that I have a different purpose here.
Yeah. And that's that fire that keeps us going, both right. of us. And that kind of leads into your other position here as executive director of Pink Forever, Ending Disparities. If you would provide our listeners and viewers some background on that organization and what you guys do.
Yeah. So our mission, as it kind of says in our name, is to eliminate breast cancer disparities for Black women. What some of our listeners might not know is that Black women are more likely to die from breast cancer, even though we're not diagnosed at the same rate. It's at an even lower rate in comparison to white women, but we have a much higher mortality death rate than white women. Black women are also diagnosed at a younger age in comparison to white women. So you see many more Black women under the age of 50, under the age of 40, and even under the age of 30 that are diagnosed with breast cancer. Much different numbers than you see among white women. And then also Black women are diagnosed with more advanced stages of breast cancer. So white women are more often diagnosed at stages 0 and 1, whereas Black women are diagnosed in 2, 3, and 4, which is harder to treat.
Right. So what, and there's probably multiple factors, but what are some of the factors for that disparity in the numbers?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's multiple things, and a lot of research still going on about that, and that's one of the reasons why Pink Forever Ending Disparities is one of our pillars is research, because we know without research into what are the underlying causes or factors for those disparities, it's going to be impossible to solve them without that. But some of the things that we do know is that some of it is because of too much time between when a Black woman is identified as having a breast problem and the time that they get follow-up and start treatment.
Okay.
And there are a variety of reasons that can happen. One could be simply because they don't know where to go and where to access resources after having like an abnormal screening mammogram or abnormal breast exam. Or maybe they know where to go, but they don't have insurance coverage, or they don't know about programs that are available, which Janessa is one of those programs that can pay for diagnostic services. So, you know, women now, because of changes in regulations with insurance, you could pretty much get a screening mammogram at no cost.
Okay.
Right. But if you need those follow-up diagnostic services and, heaven forbid, treatment, depending on your insurance coverage, it may or may not pay for that.
Okay.
And so, you know, when a woman and her family is faced with that, kind of like I was when I was initially, you know, identified my own breast problem, I was hesitant. You know, like, I'm not sure we want to spend the money this month to, you know, for that test. But then the other thing that comes into that is fear. A lot of it is fear of the unknown or fear about having seen what someone else went through. And unfortunately, that fear can sometimes paralyze you, right?
Right.
And I'm not saying that doesn't happen among all cultures, but it certainly seems to be more prominent within the Black community that kind of fear. Oh, my grandmother had cancer. She had surgery, and 3 weeks later, she died. Well, that's not the whole story, but that's what it looks like, particularly if you experienced that as a child, and that's all you know. And so. Yeah. I'm just going to, you know, not pay attention to this. Right. And then there are, you know, there are other things just in terms of systemic problems within the healthcare industry, whether that be that some Black women simply just are not treated the same way. Their, you know, concerns about side effects may be dismissed, or particularly with young women, their concerns about a potential breast abnormality are sometimes blown off. What? No, you're too young. Young women don't get, this isn't cancer because you're too young.
Okay.
It's sort of ignoring the fact that, but Black women get cancer at younger ages. So yes, I'm 30 and I'm presenting here with a breast problem, and that provider might say, oh, don't worry about that. You're not at that age, you know, where cancer is
instead of actually investigating the issue.
Right. Further. You know, and if that person, you know, that woman does not know to advocate for herself or have someone advocating for her, I would rather, you know, get whatever appropriate test there is and find out than to just, you know, blow it off and say, oh, that can't be you.
Right. And then risk it growing, spreading. And then by the time they figure it out, you're stage three instead of stage one.
Yes, and that's the kind of thing that happens in our education efforts. That's the way we address, you know, fear. That, you know, yes, you may be fearful about it, but think about this. If there's something there, if you ignore it, it's still there. You might not be thinking about it, but it's still there. It's still growing, and it could make your chances of surviving decrease because you've waited too long.
Okay. How do you guys go to market, so to speak? I mean, what are some of the services and programs that you guys are providing and educating the public? I know it's a big piece of that.
Right. So, Vince, we really pride ourselves on the fact that we try to have a program initiative that covers breast cancer across that whole continuum of care. So whether that's about education and awareness or, you know, during the diagnosis stage, providing those resources and services, helping with treatment. But then that other arm is the research that I've talked about. So. Yeah. And then we try to design our programs and initiatives to really address where the need is based upon what the research is showing.
Okay.
So, for instance, some years ago, we were involved in a research project with actually is a local researcher over at the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health. She did a research study tracking Black women as they went through breast cancer treatment.
Okay.
And those women who were participants, they would report each week, you know, what happened during that week, what happened good, what happened bad, what were the issues and challenges. And then at the end of their treatment, we would do a post-interview where we just go back through with them and we would have charted out, you know, what they said mm-hmm. in their sort of journaling during their treatment and what were the highs and what were the lows, what was happening. So out of that project, one of the things that we learned was many Black women wish they had better support during their treatment course from people that look like them. They reported, you know, having, you know, gone to a hospital for treatment, and maybe that hospital told them about a support group that was within the hospital, but they would go to that support group and nobody in there looked like them. Okay. And not just not look like them, many of them would not have the same kind of challenges and issues that they were dealing with, whether sure. that be, you know, family or work life or whatever. And they just wanted someone even outside of their family, maybe their families and churches were supporting them, but someone that had a better sense of what they were really going through.
Yeah. Right.
So out of that, we formed a group called Sisters Inspired to Stand.
Okay.
And it is a support and empowerment group for both survivors and caregivers, which we thought was important to include the caregivers because also in some of our research work, as well as just in our experience with breast cancer patients, those caregivers are really family members are impacted just as much as the person yeah. undergoing treatment.
Right.
And they, you know, sometimes they're the ones that are, you know, taken off from work, or they're the ones that are, you know, dealing with even some of the emotional issues that are a little bit different perhaps than what the person that's in treatment is doing.
Right.
And so we felt like that it was important to not only recognize that, but also to give them a forum to, you know, be around other people that, you know, had similar things going on, to
right.
encourage each other, to uplift each other, to introduce each other to resources that might be helpful. I might know about a resource that you never heard of. Was it within
sure.
that space that we can share that kind of information? So Sisters Inspired to Stand meets monthly for what we call empowerment parties. And that could be bringing in a, you know, expert speaker about something, or it could be a time of fellowship, or it could be, you know, going out somewhere. But again, it provides a forum for those survivors and caregivers to share. And then in between those monthly meetings, we have a chat group, a private chat group. So
okay.
anytime someone, you know, someone recently, I'm getting ready to start radiation, I'm really concerned about my hair. I've heard that, you know, X, Y, and Z might happen to my hair.
Right.
Anybody have any suggestions? What did you do? And so people just start saying, this is what I did. You know, so it's really, really helpful in that respect. So like I said, we try to design our programming around those kinds of things where we know there's a need.
Right.
And maybe by fulfilling that need, that can help to eliminate the disparity.
Right.
So so just a couple of other examples. We have a mammography assistance program.
Okay.
Someone is uninsured, doesn't have access to a mammogram, they can get that through us.
Nice.
Right. We have a financial assistance initiative, where people who are in treatment, if they have suffered a financial setback because of that, if they're, you know, struggling with paying rent or getting food or clothing their children, whatever that need is, we have that assistance program, and they can apply for help from us. And I think what's unique about our assistance fund is we will also pay for the cost of genetic testing for families. If someone, you know, has been recommended for genetic testing, has a family member, and for whatever reason, if it's not going to be covered by insurance or if there's a copay, we can help with that. I don't think there's any other local organization that is providing
that I'm aware of.
Yeah. But again, that's something that we decided to add to our financial assistance program because we knew about research showing that Black families do not undergo genetic testing at the same rate as other ethnicities. And so as a way to remove, if the barrier is finances, we want to remove that barrier, right?
Sure.
Or now we're about to do another research project with the IU professor that is looking at what are the reasons why it's harder to get Black families to undergo that genetic testing. So we're partnering with her to help with some focus groups and actually to have some of our constituents who have undergone genetic testing to be available to talk to those families who might be facing that and you know, just providing information. This is what we did and how we did it, what the process was like. Not trying to tell them to do it, but just trying to provide information so that they can make an informed decision.
Right.
About
yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. Well, this month being October and Breast Cancer Awareness Month, what advice would you provide a young female who might find themselves in the same situation that you were in? How would you educate them, or what tips would you provide them?
I think the most important thing is listening to your body and then taking action based upon anything that you notice is a change. You know, Vince, we know our bodies better than anybody, better than our health providers. We know our bodies, and we also are in the best position to recognize if something just feels a little different, looks a little different, acts a little different, whatever that it is, and to not ignore that.
Right.
I often say to people when I'm doing education, your body will talk to you. If there's something wrong, it's going to react in some way. That's just how we're built. And so being in tune with your body and watching for those changes and then not ignoring them, taking action. And then if you need resources, you know, it's a lot available in the community, but the problem is that everybody doesn't know about it. Yeah. So one of our initiatives that I didn't mention is our breast health advocates. We train women in the community to serve as advocates. Yeah. And their role is to not only to educate, but to also to connect people with resources. And whether those are resources from Pink Forever or resources with some of our, you know, partners and other agencies in, you know, Indianapolis and Indiana who are doing great work as well. We love collaborations. And so if it's something that, you know, they need and we don't have it, well, we're going to, you know, direct them somewhere else.
Sure.
And so, you know, often when women have a mammogram through Pink Forever, if they need a diagnostic, well, yes, Janessa Referee Clinic can help you with that. And so we're making those connections. And so people don't feel like that they can't take action because of a barrier.
Right. Well, that's great. Well, Lisa, we really appreciate all that you're doing. Keep it up.
Thank you.
We appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come up here and share your story. And again, I wish you much success, not just personally in your survivorship, but with all that you're doing here.
Well, thank you. And the same for Heroes Foundation, and all the great work that you all are doing. And we're just in it together. Like I said, it's going to take all of us in our lanes, but going towards the same solution.
Agreed. Yeah. All right. Hey, thank all you guys for tuning into this episode of the Summits Podcast. So for wherever you guys get your podcast, if you're tuning in here to the Heroes Foundation YouTube channel, thank you for doing so. And don't forget, guys, beat cancer.